All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we got a packed show for you today. It's one that I've been waiting for quite some time, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it as much as I did making it. All right, so check this out. At the back end of the show, we're going to hear something from The Vault, an interview I did earlier this year with Sarah Thomason from the UC Berkeley Labor Center. Now, we talk about the disproportionate number of Latino workers and other workers of color in what we now call essential industries, from farm work to grocery stores and the large number of low-wage jobs in those industries. Conditions at work, as well as the crowded living conditions poor people are forced into, have contributed to the very outrageous high death tolls we saw during the latest surge of COVID-19 cases. And opening the show up is May Day 2021, International Revolutionary May 1st. Saturday, May 1st marks something not seen in a long time in this country. Over 300 people nationally in Los Angeles, New York City, Chicago, and other cities came together under the banner of revolution to declare that we are human beings. We refuse to accept slavery in any form, and to learn about and get organized for an actual revolution to put an end to this system. We'll hear two statements from the celebration in Los Angeles. Joe Veal, a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on connecting with Bob Avakian during the 1970s, and Noche Diaz, the national spokesperson for the Revolution Clubs.
I didn't really get to know like Bob Avakian until I went to prison, when I was sent to prison in the early 1970s. Because then I got a chance to really like study him, to study his method of thinking. You know, I was struggling with by other prisoners there in prison. Because I came into prison, I was very like angry, given up for what had happened, off of the 60s and what had happened to the Panthers, and how people had split apart and departed from the road of revolution. That the hope that things could be like better wasn't there anymore. Well, these prisoners struggled with me. If I was still like serious, if I was really like serious about revolution, then I had to read what Bob Avakian has written. I had to engage his work, and which I did. And the first thing they had me to read was what Bob Avakian had written about the oppression of black people. It was in Red Papers number 5 and Red Papers number 6 about the black national question, how it was rooted in this system, and how only like revolution to uproot this system, overthrow it, could bring about their liberation. When they had me to read that, I had to recognize, even though I had to recognize that I had never seen this kind of method and approach, the way that Bob Avakian went about like analyzing the problem and the solution. It was a real systematic and a real scientific like way that he went about like things. And I began to see that this was different. I began to see that it was possible. It was still like it was possible to be able to make revolution. Why? Because of the work that Bob Avakian had like done. Because he had a method. He had a method and approach that when it could identify where the problem like lies at and what has to be like done to dig it out like at his root. But then, you know, you had people like saying, even then, at that time, you had people like saying, well, you shouldn't like listen to anybody like white trying to tell you about like black people, black the struggle of like black people, whatever, and like that. But that begs the question, that begs the central like question, what, is it true or not? Is what anybody like say, is it true or not? Does it reflect reality? Is what Bob of his analysis of the situation, the conditions of black people, he applied this same method to everything. Did it reflect reality or not? That was the key issue. Not who like said it or whatever, what their race was or their gender or whatever, but was it scientific? Because if it's scientific, we can get to the root of the problem and begin like to dig it out. And when I began to see that and understand that, it changed me. It changed, because before that, before before I did that, I really didn't give a f- about like what happened, whether I lived or died. If I live 5 more minutes, I said, it's going to be on my turn. And fuck it, which would have been on the terms of this system. Because that hope for revolution, it wasn't there anymore. But it was when I started to engage BA, I could see not only that we had could have like hope, but we really could like do this. Because we had like a method and approach. That was really like science, that really is scientific. That we can take up ourselves and become, then we can take up ourselves the same way that Bob Avakian does and use it and utilize it to emancipate not only ourselves but all humanity. This is the difference that that had like made. Yeah. And so, you know, once I did that, I couldn't wait to get out of prison. Once I, you know, met Bob Avakian and started like reading and studying and stuff, I could not wait to get, I was in a hurry to get out of prison. You know, because I wanted to meet him. I wanted to learn from him. I wanted to get with the Revolutionary Communist Party. I wanted to get like with all this here. And when I got out, what was happening? The first thing that was happening, they was trying to put Bob Avakian in jail for over 200 years for a demonstration where he had defended him and hundreds of others and went out in the streets and defended Mao Zedong and opposed the coup, the capitalist coup in China after the death of Mao. And they came down viciously on him. They had blueprints of his living situation. You know, they had blueprints and floor plans of his living situation, while at the same time they was trying to put him away for 200 years. So 200 of us volunteered to go to D.C. and to politically turn D.C. upside down. And I said, and other people like said, we'll do anything and go anywhere to prevent them from taking this revolutionary leadership from us. That this is something that's really precious. This is something that we don't get all the time in our lives. It doesn't like come around all the time. And when it does come around, not only do we have to protect it, but we have to follow it. We have to take it up and follow it and spread it. And they help like strengthen it and build a wall around this leadership so they can't get all, so they can't like get to it. And one thing that we like know, you know, one of many things that we like know, but one thing I just want to point out like here, that any time that this system sees leadership and it begins to mobilize, that's what the Panthers did, when it begins like to mobilize these basic like black youth into a revolution, to begin to dedicate their life for that and get out of the bullshit that this system traps them in, that this had a real, this has a real big impact and influence on other sections in society, on other youth of other races, on white youth, Latino youth, etc. This is what like happened. And when they see that begin like to take place, they go after that leadership to try to like snuff it out. And that's what they were doing. That's what they did to some in the 60s. That's what they was trying to do like the BA when I got out of prison. And we was able like to prevent that by, you know, volunteer to go to DC and turn DC upside down politically and to build that while beginning to build a wall around this leadership. So we need to do that even more today. Because, you know, not only like that, but we need to project this leadership. We need to take this out, spread this everywhere. When I was in prison, look, a lot of us, we were studying revolutionary theory. We were studying communist theory. We were studying, we had our groups there in prison. But some people was really, you know, I would have to say they was really like dogmatic and religious about it. And some of it was, you know, that things are just going to like work out. And you get this kind of vision that someday, magically, revolution is going to work out. It wasn't scientific like at all. That was some of the weaknesses. That was one of the weaknesses in that first stage of the revolution. But Bob Avakian has gotten rid of all of that in communist understanding and made it more scientific, more like thorough and stuff. And that's why I think we can do what we started off trying to do in the 1960s. because of the leadership and the work that Bob Avakian has done, that we can have that opportunity to do what we was only start beginning to try to do back during that time. So, in ending, let me say this. Hey, we have a leader with a revolutionary line, and Bob Avakian is right on time. Yeah. Right. Say that with me.
Yeah. Right on time.
We have a leader with a revolutionary line. And Bob Avakian is right on time.
And Bob Avakian is right on time.
We have a leader with a revolutionary line. Bob Avakian is right on time. And you got to say it, and you got to mean it. And you got to tell others that I follow Bob Avakian, and you should too. And this is the reason why, because we need science. We need scientific leadership. We need Bob Avakian and what he has brought forth.
Yeah. Now let's hear Noche Diaz.
You heard earlier, and everybody knows about the way that the police murdered George Floyd. But during the course of this trial, and you watched the footage that came out from the body cams, even before the knee was on George Floyd's neck, these cops were trying to strip him of his humanity. And you could watch and see as he's in the car and he's trying to reason with these unreasonable animals wearing those badges, trying to hold on to his dignity, trying to do anything he can, and you watch it and you know, and you can see that he knows that anything and nothing could end up with him being dead. This is one of the ways all the damn time they remind you that under this system, you are not a human being. They done Adam Toledo in a very similar way. Young kid, 13 years old. They're chasing through an alleyway and they tell him stop and put your hands up, and he does it, only to take a bullet and to bleed out on the floor and die. Another way they tell you, you are not a human being who deserves to live. We can go on and on and on. Think about when you first heard about those immigrant children at the border being put in cages and ripped from their families. In some of these situations, not even given toilet paper or soap or toothbrushes. That's the way they tell those people and people just like them that you are not a human being. Or think about what they're doing to our planet, destroying every inch of it, jeopardizing whether or not human beings will be able to live for further generations. It's another way they tell you that your humanity doesn't matter. Or think about the way women have to walk through this world. Maybe some of you thinking about coming today had to remind yourself that when you go anywhere in this planet as a woman, you can be broken down and be treated as something that isn't a human being. And if you're a guy, you learn to do that and not only deprive women of their humanity, but you lose your own in the process. Well, goddammit, that does not go down here.
Hell no.
When we say we are human beings, we are human beings. That is not just an empty slogan. That is going up against everything about the way this world is. And it has everything to do with the world we're fighting to bring into being. We are human beings and we refuse to accept slavery in any form. When you step into the revolution, not only do you learn not to degrade other people, you learn to reclaim your humanity as part of fighting to liberate all of humanity. You learn to go up against all the me first, I way of thinking that keeps this whole thing going, and you learn to put humanity first and the whole world first. When you step into the revolution and put on one of these shirts, you learn that women, men, differently gendered people with different sexual orientations can be equals and all have a shared humanity. when you put on this shirt and you step into the revolution. Instead of all this America first, thinking that people in other parts of the world and other countries don't matter, you learn to see people from different nationalities who speak different languages as equal human beings and as equals and comrades. When you put on this shirt and you step into the revolution, instead of going along with this system's way, when you're born into this mess and growing up and thinking, well, if this is the world we got, then we gotta get whatever we can while we're in it. Even if that means fighting and killing people just like you in the next block or in the next set and in the next neighborhood. Instead of all that, you learn that you are no less capable of a human being and you can be part of fighting to end all oppression and emancipate humanity. Yeah. There is something to live for and when necessary, die for, and it's not going along with this system. It's not putting up with its outrages, and it's not trying to do for yourself. It's in doing everything we can to make a revolution, to get this system off of everybody's backs, and to actually create a future worth living, not just for ourselves, but again, for the future of humanity. This is why we say in this declaration from the RevComs, which just came out very recently, repeatedly, it says, let's get back to the basics. We need revolution, nothing less. We don't need to learn to live with any of this oppression. We don't need to learn how to just fight for scraps while the people who run this planet run it into the ground on the backs of the masses of people and all of humanity. We don't need to learn to start blaming other oppressed people for the situation we're in. We need to come together and look at the system that has caused all this oppression. But when we say revolution, we also have to be very clear, as it is in this declaration. We're not going for anything less than the overthrowing this whole system, defeating, disarming, and dismantling the murderous armed power and other institutions that enforce this system, completely abolishing this whole system and replacing it with something radically different and much better, a new society built on an entirely different foundation. This is what we mean when we say, and we wear this shirt that says, revolution, nothing less. We can't accept anything else, and we live in times where that kind of revolution could actually become possible if we seize these times and build up the forces that are necessary to make something good out of this terrible situation. This is what you're part of doing when you put on this shirt, when you step into this revolution, and when you join the revolution clubs. The two slogans and missions of the revolution club start with one. Again, what humanity needs is revolution and the new communism of Bob Avakian. That is what we are saying to the world. That is what is needed. We don't need more people who are telling people how to live with this or just helping people endure their suffering and oppression. We need people who go and tell people what humanity needs to get free from all this oppression. And two, the second slogan and mission of the Revolution Clubs is fight the power and transform the people for revolution. We're not working for reforms, but we're also not just waiting for one fine day when revolution becomes possible. We are working every day to build up struggle against the crimes of this system, to prevent them from completely grounding people down, but also as part of transforming people and working to change the thinking of people and build up the organization. Because it all is part of getting people and getting a core of leadership ready for a time when we can bring this system down. And that is what we are organizing in these revolution clubs. So this is what the kind of organization that you step into when you put on this shirt and when you step into this revolution club. At the core of these clubs, again, are followers of Bob Avakian and others who are stepping into this process and learning more as they take part in building this revolution. And I'm not gonna go on and on here about this, but we have a strategy for how we could win. We have a strategy for how we're working today, and also there's a strategy for how once we do get into a different situation, we can get a thing going where we can take on all of their might, all of their oppressive power, all of their violent instruments, and actually beat them. They are not all powerful. And how inhuman they are is one of their weaknesses. It's one of the reasons we're gonna be able to beat them. Because as people see what this system does, the way those police did George Floyd and 1,000 other people every year just like that, the way this military goes around in places like Afghanistan or with their CIA going to other countries and carrying out assassinations, they enforce all this inhumanity all throughout the world. And when more people see that, the more they no longer put up with going along with it. But they also need to see something else. They need to see a force of people who are representing and fighting for something totally different. And that's one of the ways in which people who start off and don't know what they think about revolution are going to learn what they think about it and learn which side they're on and how they're going to be part of this fight. And that's going to be true in a future situation in a whole different kind of level. When you think about something that happened at on the RNL show last night, the Revolution Nothing Less show on YouTube, which you should go watch. They did an interview with Joe Ergo, who was a military vet who was part of the Vietnam War. And he signed up for that all gung-ho for America and learned about all the crimes that were being carried out against the Vietnamese people in the service of empire. One of the stories he told, though, was how as a young teenager, 17, 18-year-old, they get you in there, and the cadence calls that they do while they're marching you through basic training includes things like rape, kill, mutilate, 2, 4, 6, 8. And songs about how napalm sticks to children, celebrating the kind of destruction that it causes and carries out. And several other kinds of chants just like this. This is an example of how they train their forces and what they're fighting for. And in a different way, while we're not training a military force to wage an actual war now, we are training a political force in the Revolution Club to wage a political war now against this system to build up the strength to bring it down. And when you learn to march with the Revolution Clubs, you learn different chants and cadence calls that are about emancipating humanity, that are about seeing our common cause with each other, that is about learning about science and love, yes, and about revolution, not about how to tear other people down and lose your humanity in the course of fighting. And this is one of the ways in which we're going to work on changing the people even now, as they see people who are actually living that. You know, you hear all the time, when we talk to you in the revolution, we like what you say, but I don't think anybody else out here is going to be able to do anything you're talking about. But when people start to see that there's growing forces of people who are stepping out and learning to act together in a conscious, revolutionary way, this begins to pose in people's thinking that maybe they can't come up with those excuses anymore. Maybe they can't keep telling themselves all the reasons that they tell themselves to not be amongst the first. And there's a million reasons. I'm sure everyone here has had to ask themselves a lot of questions and come up with a lot of answers to be able to find your way here. And we know people who didn't make it because of all these million reasons that come up. But at the end of the day, as you heard in the film clip from Bob Avakian, there may be a million questions and a million arguments against it, but at the end of the day, the thing that we need to see, that this system does everything it can to get people to not see, is that we really have two choices. We either live with this system, we either live with all this oppression and madness, we either live with all this and condemn future generations to the same or worse if they have a future at all, or we make revolution. That's a choice we all have to make. But more than that, when you choose to not only be part of making revolution, but to be part of those who are stepping out and saying, we are the ones who are going to organize and lead you to make this revolution. That's a precious thing for the masses of people who find it, as Bob Avakian has also said, very difficult to even hope. Masses of people who are afraid to hope because those hopes have been betrayed so often. So to have a leader like this And then to have people who are taking up that mission and stepping into the Revolution Clubs is a precious thing. And I want you all to join me in welcoming those people who are here today who have newly begun to put on the Revolution Nothing Less shirts, who have newly begun to step into the Revolution Clubs or are renewing their commitment. And I want those folks to actually start making their way to the front too, because we actually want to have a ceremony to acknowledge this, okay? This is not just something to take for granted. It's not just a personal choice you have to make. This is something we are doing together. Again, it's not everybody out for themselves. It's everybody who wants and hungers for justice and a whole different world. Having each other's backs is part of fighting to get all of humanity free.
I recently discovered the UC Berkeley Labor Center and the recent work that they produced, Frontline Essential Jobs in California, a profile of job and worker characteristics. Now, this work was produced by Sarah Thomason and Annette Bernhardt, who work with the Labor Center, and they've pulled together a very compelling piece of work on the subject titled Frontline Essential Jobs in California, a profile of job and worker characteristics. And joining us to talk about this work right now is Sarah Thomason. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, sure. So the first piece of your work that you put out on display was samples of press coverage around Latino COVID-19 deaths hitting horrifying levels up to, you know, 1,000. Since November in LA County alone. Now, this was a sample of what was happening in early January of this year. Let's talk about that sample and then where it's going now.
Well, you know, I'm not a public health expert, so I can't really comment too much on the trends and the cases and what's likely to happen. But I can talk a little bit about what we know about the risk of exposure in the workplace.
That would be good. That'd be very good.
Yeah. So, and one, I do want to clarify that we still don't have really conclusive research that shows that workplace exposure is causing this disparity in cases where we're seeing much higher rates of infection and mortality among especially Black and Latino residents in California. And there's still a lot that we are learning about all the different factors that determine a person's risk level for being exposed to the virus. So there really could be additional factors that are contributing to this. So, for example, living in more densely populated areas or overcrowded housing may also increase your risk of exposure. Also, the type of transportation that you're using. So there's a difference if you're able to drive yourself around versus if you are relying on public transportation or using Uber and Lyft. But we do know that the workplace is an important site of infection, and we've seen a lot of media reporting on specific outbreaks in work sites, in restaurants, in grocery stores, in meat packing plants, in warehouses. And there's a couple of studies done in Asia and Europe that suggests that maybe 15 to 25% of cases are coming from workplace exposure. Not a lot of counties are reporting on this type of data, but San Diego County is an exception. And they have been reporting on where people who test positive may have become infected. They find that the workplace is a possible site of infection in about 1 out of 3 cases. So definitely this is a cause for concern. And on top of that, there's also evidence that low-wage workers and workers of color may be at increased risk of exposure at work for a few different reasons. One, they're less likely to be able to work from home. They're also more likely to be essential workers. And especially in the beginning of the pandemic, when we had these really strict shelter-in-place orders, those were primarily the only workers that were out in their original work site in the community. And three, they're also more likely to have closer physical proximity to others at work, which, you know, a lot of research suggests also is a risk factor.
Now, you know, along those lines, I'm just thinking about this and something that I read where, you know, you're talking about this. And I want to know if there was any more we could dig into, because one of the major dangers at that time was the fact that, as we said, many essential workers remained in place to continue carrying out their work. Very dangerous. Yeah. And it's very dangerous, as you're pointing out, you know, both for them and them personally, and because of the character of the work and its relationship in terms of infections that can be spread along, all the stuff that was actually basically leaving things the way they were, pushing things the way they were, actually was something that could bring and may have brought a huge problem to a lot of people that didn't even know that they were having a problem.
Yeah, well, for sure. So definitely, among essential workers, they're more likely to be low-wage workers. They're also more likely to be Black and Latino. So, and a lot of this is due to the fact that in California, much like in the rest of the country, a lot of our occupations are segregated by race and ethnicity and gender. So some of the most common occupations that are also considered essential, like food prep workers, cooks, construction laborers, personal care aides, home health aides, janitors, cashiers, those are all occupations that also are disproportionately people of color. And they also typically pay low wages. And those are the people that were considered essential and were still out in the community at their work site. And potentially having greater risk. But even beyond those workers who were considered essential, at the very beginning and during the most restrictive shelter-in-place orders, those were the only workers that were out in the community working. But for a lot of the year, you know, we went through periods where we were opening and closing the economy to different degrees. And so there was different configurations of which groups of workers were out in the community. And so a lot of times it even went beyond just essential workers, those workers that were considered essential. And so that's why we also did an analysis looking at the entire labor force. Who are the workers who have greater physical contact, physical proximity to other people on the work site, so that in the event that everybody was back at work, even beyond essential workers, who is going to be most at risk potentially? And even there, even beyond the essential workers, we still do see a lot of inequities there, where we see that a lot of the occupations that have much closer physical proximity to others also tend to be low-paid jobs and also disproportionately Black and Latino workers.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, because that's exactly what I was going to ask you next, which was actually, you know, this whole point that you're hitting at, and maybe we could dig into it a little bit more, but who these workers are that are pulled into all this, you know, because people are going to work and they're going out and they're doing the job. And I don't even know how much people even understand or know about what actually is at stake when they're going out and doing this job in this kind of circumstances, you know, because you talk about, you know, you folks talk about this thing of both the, as you're pointing out, that the frontline essential jobs in California that are likely to be a risk of workplace exposure to the coronavirus. And then this idea and I think it's important that people get a deeper understanding of that, because too often I think we just walk around and, you know, you see the people that are out there collecting the garbage, they're doing this, they're doing that, they're doing things that are absolutely essential for basically the functioning of society, but they're actually doing this at an expense that's very, very horrible and could be very horrible and threatening to their own well-being. And so I wanted to talk about that, and also who these people are that are getting pulled into all this, because, you know, it's people tend to see or hear the names and what's what this is or what that is, or, you know, that, yes, that's my janitor, that's this, even the idea that it's my janitor, you know. But there's this whole idea, people need to understand, who are these people and what is it that they have to actually be conscious of in their life in relation to being part of this whole mess here?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think, you know, one of the really interesting things about this pandemic is that it has shown us just how critical these workers are, especially our service workers, not just for our economy, but to keep us alive, to keep us well fed, to keep us healthy. And so I think that now we are really feeling at a much more significant level than we did prior to the pandemic, just how much we need those workers. And so now people are calling these workers heroes for risking their health and their lives. And, you know, like you mentioned, what is it that they're risking? They're also potentially risking the health of their family members and the people that they live with as well in order to do their jobs. But at the same time, as we're calling them essential and heroes, we're also telling them that they aren't worthy of a living wage. You know, so I think that this is a great time to come back to the discussion about what should workers be making and what is a living wage. And, you know, there have been some local governments that have passed laws, such as in Oakland, recently passed an ordinance requiring large grocery chains to pay workers an additional $5 an hour in hazard pay as a way to try to partially compensate them for these additional health risks that they face that you mentioned. So I think that is a good start. Also, this national discussion that we're having now finally at the federal level about increasing the minimum wage is really critical. If the federal minimum wage had been keeping pace with increases in worker productivity since the 60s, it would now be over $24 an hour. So, and right now the minimum wage in California statewide is 12. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a really good opportunity for us to reconsider how we're distributing income in our country and how we're, what it means to really, truly, fairly compensate our workers.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time, though, the things that you've brought out that I thought were very, very important, because nobody else is bringing this out. And when you folks did your report, this is something that really stood out to me. This point about the prevalence of low-wage work focusing on the 15 largest occupations. You know, this is something that people need to know about, because it's not just sort of like people go out and get jobs and they get this, you know, they're looking for work, they get a job, they're just, you know, going, doing their day in and day out. But there actually is, and nobody knows about, you know, what the danger is or something like this, but there's actually the prevalence of low-wage work focusing on the 15 largest occupations. That says something about the character of the society we live in right now.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because one of the misconceptions that a lot of people have is that it's okay to pay workers low wages, because these are young workers, they're just getting started, they're gaining experience, they're training, that it's just a stepping stone for later on moving into the higher paid positions. But that's just not the case. That's not how our economy is working in reality. You know, in California, in 2017, one out of three workers in California was earning low wages. So these are workers across the entire age spectrum of all races and ethnicities. And they're not just doing work that anybody could, you know, just pick up and do without any kind of training or experience. So, for example, construction workers, cooks, personal care aides that are taking care of people with disabilities and the elderly, nurses, janitors, these are all jobs that take real skill and also experience to do well. So,
it's a very important point. Very important point to raise there. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sarah Thomason about frontline essential jobs in California, and it's a profile of job and worker characteristics. And it's actually, I tell you, this piece, folks, I read this and I thought, you know, I knew a lot about it, I was keeping in touch and stuff, but a lot of the stuff that's been put out on this report is really important for people to get and to read and to understand what the character of the society we live in, the character of the society that's being promoted and you know, around the world is like, oh, well, you know, America has this really great whatever. And then you get to see the reality, the glimpse of the reality, the real deal for what's happening for a lot of people who just basically trying to keep their life is actually costing them their lives in a lot of ways. And that's one thing I wanted to ask you about, Sarah, because you're talking about this and you know, again, the deaths among Latinos in LA County from COVID rising to astonishing levels and getting it at more and more than double the rate of whites in LA County. People living in the most impoverished neighborhoods, as you hinted to, you know, people living in the most impoverished neighborhoods are averaging 36 deaths per day, 36 deaths per day per 100,000 residents. This is absolutely this is absolutely terrible. On one hand, the people are living in the wealthiest areas are experiencing all this stuff, about 10 deaths a day. And this is what's happening to the people who have no standing in society generally.
Yeah, I think that what we're going through is, it's in some ways, it's really hard for us to even just comprehend the size of it, because it's so huge what's happening. And I think it really just is showing how deep these structural issues are, like racism and sexism and our class system are really just very embedded in our society in terms of like health and space and work. And, you know, this is the result that we're seeing from the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Now, this isn't accidental either. I mean, in a certain sense, because as you've mentioned in, before, and I think again mentioned in the piece that you guys put together, this thing of the prevalence of low-wage work focusing on the 15 largest occupations. This is something that's actually, you can actually follow the yellow brick road and see what's going where and who's at the other end of the yellow brick road. And that's one of the things I think that people talk about it a lot. But when you actually look at and this is what I found really, really important about what you're saying. One of the things I found really important about what you folks have been saying, it's that it's not just like saying, okay, I notice that this is what's happening, but it's actually understanding what are the real forces out there that are carrying out the kind of, working situation where people, literally a certain class of people, have to every day get up, put on their clothes, go out and put their lives in jeopardy. In a way that doesn't have to be put in jeopardy. And I thought that was really, really important to speak to.
Yeah, I think that list, looking at that list, and like I said before, we still don't have research that shows this causal relationship between exposure at work and the disparity in the cases of COVID-19 by race and ethnicity. But there is a lot of evidence that suggests that this is, potentially one major factor that's contributing to that. For example, there was a report that was just released a couple months ago by UCSF, and they compared death certificates in California from 2019 to 2020, and they were able to calculate and see the occupation on those death certificates and look at the difference in mortality rate year over year by occupation. And a lot of these same occupations that we see are the most common essential worker occupations, and that also have a high proportion of low-wage workers, are also some of the occupations that saw the biggest increase in their mortality rates. For example, the top one was cooks, and farm workers was also up there. So I think that this is something we should all be really concerned about, and I think some of the things that could be done to try to protect workers, one, employers, there's a lot that employers can do to protect their workers. They can implement policies like changing staffing and work pace and scheduling to allow for more distance between workers, putting in different kinds of protective barriers or other systems to increase safety. And two, we also need to put policies into place to protect workers. And for example, Cal OSHA did implement some new regulations last November to make employers put systems in place for identifying exposure hazards and also to check if workers have symptoms and have been doing regular testing. And also, I think it's really important that we make sure that workers have a voice in the workplace, because they know their workplace is the best. They are the experts, and they should feel safe calling to attention potentially unsafe practices and also be a part of developing the solution. So I think that's going to be really important. And LA County did pass an ordinance last fall to protect workers from retaliation. So I think that that's a good start and a good example for other counties and places to consider.
Well, let me throw a little something into the fire here, because there's also, even as you're talking, I'm thinking about this thing, we've been talking about who is getting really, hit by this, who's on the really terrible end of things. And we're talking about the people that are living in the, that we're not talking about the people who are living in the wealthiest areas, because when they're there, they're getting like, there's 10 deaths a day per 100,000 residents or something. But when you look at the people who are out, who are brought in to do the kind of work, the kind of work that's very dangerous on, you know, even more so than just normally. And I know one thing that you were putting forward in your what you wrote about this, Latino residents in LA County are dying at an astonishing 8 times the rate they once did. 8 times the rate they once did. 3.5 daily deaths per 100,000 in early November to 28 deaths a day for every 100,000. A staggering increase of over 800%. That is absolutely unacceptable on any level. And I'd like to, you know, hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah, I definitely agree that it is completely unacceptable. And it's very clear that some communities in California have experienced a disproportionate amount of the burden of the pandemic, both in the infections and the deaths, like you mentioned. Also economically and financially, these are the same groups of workers that also experience the most job losses. And so in a lot of ways, many families in California and likely in LA County also are dealing with illness, either their own or a family member. They may also be dealing with unemployment and the financial repercussions of that. So maybe concerned about how they're going to pay their rent or how they're going to put food on the table for their family. So this is just, it's a pandemic that's hitting people from a lot of different angles. And definitely the effects are felt very differently across different demographic groups.
Mm-hmm. And again, the death toll for these people, for the people who are getting hit the hardest, the death toll for them continues to grow. And I think I read in your report that new cases reported daily were 15,100 people. This is unfathomable when you think about it. And California's Latino and Black residents and people with no more than a high school education suffered among the highest increase of deaths of all this. So you have this situation where you have the people who sit on top, the people who do this and do that, and their shirts are always clean and their shoes are never muddy. But then you have all these other people who are out doing all this stuff, and they are the ones who are being pushed into not physically, but basically reality, pushing them into it in terms of wanting to stay alive and wanting to keep their families alive. And they're being pushed into and made to actually accept this horrifying, horrifying situation. I mean, even again, the death toll continues to grow. New cases reported daily, 15,100. This is absolutely outrageous.
Yeah, I agree. It is completely, it's a tragedy. And I hope that the best that can come of this is that we really recognize and what has happened and what has led to this, and that we use it as an opportunity as we're starting to come up with ways to pull ourselves out of this pandemic and recover our economy, that we pay particular attention to things that we can do to address the structural racism that is embedded in our economy. And, you know, to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
Mm-hmm. Now, just off of what you just raised there, I want to go back to this thought again, too, because it sticks with everything you've written through here, that California's Latino and Black residents and people with no more than a high school education suffered among the highest increases of death. You know, this is, again, on top of everything else, on top of all the, you know, all the stuff that they have to go through and what they're doing, they're suffering the highest increase of death. And that, to me, you know, says something very, very important in terms of, you know, what are we talking about here? What's actually being, you know, put on the table here in terms of, you know, who does what, when, and how, and who, you know, who suffers in relation to this? And that there's a difference between being able to work at home and work in your office and those who cannot do that due to the nature of the work that they do. And that death toll there speaks very much to that situation.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's kind of hard when you think about this, because, you know, and again, this is not to, I'm not saying this next thing to basically say, okay, well, you know, you're always arguing about it's all about race, but actually there is an element here where the people, you know, white people who are working in these kinds of jobs don't necessarily have
they don't have to play the same game. They're not in the same game in terms of how they get treated. Like when you see the people that we're talking about earlier, probably a very small percentage of them are actually white people.
Is that a very small percentage
of the people we're talking about earlier of like who's suffering, who's doing what, how's it happening, who's it falling out against. And actually, I would imagine that people of color are actually pretty close to the big barrel of who's being screwed over with this, who's being killed with this stuff.
Well, definitely disproportionately. I think that particularly Black and Latino people in general, and also specifically workers, have been disproportionately affected in terms of their potential risk of exposure on the workplace, less likely to be able to work from home, also more likely to work in an occupation where they are in more close contact with people. So yes, disproportionately more likely, yes. But it doesn't mean that it's completely people of color are all the ones who are getting sick and white people are not. I think that, it's just that we definitely see that it's a disproportionate effect. And we can clearly see that white people are more likely to be able to work from home during this pandemic. They're also more likely to have not lost their job. So yes, I think it's clear that there's very clear differences in how people have been affected by the pandemic.
Yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I mean, I'm not saying this things that I was saying to basically say, oh, white people and all other people, people who aren't people of color are sort of somehow just like, oh, they're just running over there like pirates with knives waiting to kill everybody. There's a reality for, you know, even for a lot of people who are working in the business area. A lot of these people may not even know what the situation of the people, the poorer people, the people that are actually living on from hand to mouth. And I think that's one of the things that really attracted me about what you guys had written, because it actually does lay out something that tells people a truth that many, many people don't know, and including many people of all nationalities who just, they don't get a chance to see this, or they don't run into it, or they don't pay attention to it. But when it's being put in front of their face, you know, now, and the idea of actually bringing this to people is extremely important. And the last thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, you think about this, the average daily death rate among residents of LA County's poorest neighborhoods is three times as high as that in the wealthiest areas. And that begins to speak to something that we're just talking about. And I wanted to know if you had any comments you wanted to make on that, because it fits with a lot of the stuff that you were just saying too.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I'm not a public health expert, so I wish I could say more about a lot of the different underlying factors that are contributing to these differences that we're seeing in the infection rates and the mortality rates. But in terms of the workplace, which is more where my expertise lies and where I can better speak to, I mean, I think it's clear that, you know, for decades and really from the history of this country, from its very founding, we have seen some very deep inequities in our economic system, in our labor market, where workers of color, especially Latinos and Black workers, earn less. And we also see a lot of occupational segregation. So actually even mostly working in different types of jobs. And so the way that has played out in this pandemic is really created this, separated workers out into very different groups. We have some who didn't lose their job, are working from home, and so have been doing pretty well. Maybe some of those have really been struggling to balance childcare or dealing with kids while schools are closed. And so that is an additional burden. But, you know, they're still at home. They have less of a risk of exposure. Versus we have other workers who either have lost their jobs completely, and so now we're kind of scrambling to try to find a way to make ends meet the time when jobs are very scarce. Or workers are still on the job, but they have to go out in the community every day to do their work and interact with others. And so potentially put their health at risk, also the health of their family members at risk. And, you know, it seems very likely that those differences have contributed in some way to the differences we've seen in the mortality rates and the infection rates for Latino and Black residents of California.
Mm-hmm. Very important. All right, Sarah, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Sure. And is there, if people wanted to find out some of the information or some of the work that you're doing, is there a place or a way that they can find that out?
Yes, they could go to our website. We are thelaborcenter.berkeley.edu. You can find us just with a Google search for the UC Berkeley Labor Center. And there you can find more of the research that we've been doing on low-wage work, on a number of topics relating to workers and wages, and also research that we've been doing specifically on how the pandemic is affecting workers.
All right, Sarah Thomason, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Take care now. That was Sarah Thomason from the UC Berkeley Labor Center talking about the essential workers, low-wage workers, and the conditions of work that have contributed to workers of color dying of COVID-19 at rates many times greater than those of white residents.
We'll be bringing you more about the COVID's impact on people, especially outside the U.S., in the coming weeks. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to share your thoughts and ideas about the show, or if you want to volunteer to be part of the show, write to me at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.
Slavery hasn't changed, my friend. It's just adopted a new face.
Goddamn! It's in the very fabric of American society.
Goddamn!
I couldn't stand it.
I'm treated like a piece of